Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host New Voices in Civil Rights, How Universities Are Responding to Students for Fair Admissions, featuring Leo O'Malley, Anthony Pericolo, Sam Gellin, and Peter Abernathy. Our moderator today is Devin Westill. Devin is the President and General Counsel for the Center for Equal Opportunity. Before that, he served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He has been published in Newsweek, National View, and the Wall Street Journal. He has provided testimony to both houses of Congress, the EEOC, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and as an expert witness in federal court. A graduate of UNC at Chapel Hill and the University of Florida, he has also served in the U.S. Navy and worked for the U.S. Department of Labor, the Federal Society, and as a criminal trial lawyer in private practice. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Devin, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Marco, and certainly thank you to the Federal Society for hosting us to do this. I want to thank especially the Civil Rights Practice Group Executive Committee, on which I serve, for agreeing to do this. There have been at least one or two other sort of new voices in certain types of law and policy programs at the Federal Society. I think these are fantastic. It's a great opportunity for up-and-coming new lawyers to begin to talk about the issues from their perspective that I don't think we get often enough. The Federal Society has been a platform, obviously, for lawyers who are very experienced in certain areas, but we don't get that in a lot of places even. But there's a chance here for new lawyers to share a different perspective from their early time in the law. The panelists here, by the way, are here in their personal capacities. They may have some caveats they need to give before they give their remarks, but I will try as best I can to not talk too much and just give them the mic. I should say that each one of these panelists are experienced in civil rights law and policy, although their bios on the FedSoc website, and that'll go through really quickly here, may not necessarily scream that at you, but each one of these panelists have been vetted, and they have been trained in civil rights law and policy through the Center for Equal Opportunity. Each one of them is an alum of our inaugural Summer Civil Rights Fellowship at the Center for Equal Opportunity CEO. Each one of them was fantastic, and we're super happy to have them back as new lawyers now as we're talking about these types of issues. Our fourth annual Civil Rights Fellowship application window is going to open up. So if you're interested in being like these really well-dressed gentlemen, I'm the least well-dressed today, then keep an eye out for our application window opening up, which should be about March 1st of this year if you're a law student interested in civil rights. Not surprisingly, given what we know about these gentlemen, but they have longer bios on the FedSoc website. You can go there to take a look at that. But let me start by introducing them in the order in which they'll be giving some opening remarks. Leo O'Malley is clerking in the Eastern District of Texas. He graduated with honors from the University of Notre Dame Law School in 2023, where he served as a showcase team oralist on the Moot Court Board and the director of the 2022-2023 Religious Freedom Tournament. He recently completed a clerkship with Justice Jeanine Kern of the South Dakota Supreme Court. He loves clerking so much, he's going on to the Third Circuit in the 27-28 term. A National Merit Scholar recipient, Leo earned his BS summa cum laude from Wheaton College in Applied Mathematics and a BM in Organ Performance. Next, we'll hear from Anthony Pericolo, who's a patent litigator in Washington, D.C. Anthony is also a visiting fellow at the Center for Equal Opportunity. And in fact, Anthony was CEO's first ever visiting legal fellow during his first year as a lawyer. Anthony graduated from Harvard Law School in 2023, where he founded the Harvard Intellectual Property Law Association and was a submissions editor for the Harvard Journal of Law and Technology. Anthony earned dual degrees in economics and electrical and computer engineering from the University of Rochester. Next, we'll hear from Samuel Gallen. He's an honor law graduate attorney at the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He is a 2024 graduate of the University of Notre Dame Law School, where he also spent time clerking at the United States Commission on Civil Rights, supporting commissioners Peter Kersenow and Gail Heriot. Prior to law school, Sam worked in finance as a private wealth analyst at a leading financial services firm. He earned a BA in economics with minors in mathematics and business, magna cum laude from Wabash College in Indiana. And finally, we'll hear from Peter Abernathy. He's clerking on the 31st Circuit Court of Virginia. He's a 2024 graduate of the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. He has experience in both the public and private sectors, having worked as a crime analyst for the Memphis Police Department and a geographic information systems analyst for a private aerial imaging firm. After serving for 2 years as a missionary in southern Brazil, Peter earned his BA double majoring in geospatial intelligence and history at Brigham Young University. Again, you can go back and look at their full bios, lots of stuff to learn about these guys. Very interesting gentlemen. But to kick things off, I'm going to hand it over to Leo, who's going to give us about 10 minutes of an opening statement. So, Leo, you've got the mic.
Thank you so much, Devin. I'm excited for today. As was just said, my name is Leo O'Malley. And to sort of set the table for what we're going to be talking about today, I want to go through a little bit of the background, key holdings, a little bit of the aftermath, the Students for Fair Admissions decision came down from the Supreme Court in 2023. As I was preparing for this, I realized this is a situation where there's way too much to say in too little time, but I'm going to be try to be as brief and concise as possible. So looking a little bit at what prompted this lawsuit, this was brought in challenging the affirmative action admissions policies of both Harvard in the First Circuit and UNC in the Fourth Circuit under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And you can read a little bit more about these admissions policies in the opinion itself, but suffice to say that the district court ultimately found that in the Harvard's admission process, as well as for UNC, race would be a determinative tip factor for a significant percentage of all admitted African-American and Hispanic applicants, and that it would be considered at basically all of the different stages of the admissions process. So going into when this was challenged at the Supreme Court, at cert, the Supreme Court went through the precedential history that led up to the Students for Fair to this lawsuit. And what the Supreme Court ultimately said was that in its understanding of the original meaning of the Equal Protection Clause, the Supreme Court looked at some decisions right after the Equal Protection Clause was passed, specifically Strada versus West Virginia, which said that, referring to the clause, what is this but declaring that the law in the state shall be the same for the black as for the white, that all persons, whether colored or white, shall stand equal before the laws of the states. In the majority's view, in SFFA, that sort of set the stage for a skepticism of all racial classifications. And they drew that out, recognizing that traditionally the Supreme Court, when faced with these types of lawsuits, whether it's racial classifications, whether in the educational context or otherwise, will go to strict scrutiny, which requires a compelling governmental interest and narrow tailoring. It's normally a very high bar of scrutiny. The Supreme Court then went to look at two decisions that had preceded SFFA that had allowed, at least in some instances, the consideration of racial classifications in the admissions context. The first was Regents of the University of California versus Bakke, and this was a challenge to a set-aside admissions program at the University of California Medical School, where a certain number of seats in each class were set aside for members of minority groups, and there would be a separate admissions track for those individuals. Although the opinion was very fractured in this case, Justice Powell's writing ultimately became the touchstone for analysis in the admissions context. And he specifically rejected three rationales under the strict scrutiny analysis that the government provided. He said that interests in reducing historical deficit in minority attendance, remedying effects of societal discrimination, and increasing doctors or medical professionals in underserved areas were all insufficient under the strict scrutiny analysis. But the one interest he said got the admissions program over the hump was the justification of educational benefits of a racially diverse student body, in addition to the academic freedom to promote that by educational institutions. He put four important limits on the extent of this permission to engage in racial classifications. He specifically said no quotas. There couldn't be a multi-track system based on race. And the educational institutions couldn't foreclose an individual from consideration merely because of race. That would be a negative use of race in the admissions context. And finally, that there would need to be some sort of temporal limitation or end point to these programs. Four of the other justices in Bakke said that affirmative action could be used to remedy past discrimination. Four others would have struck down the program under Title VI. So that takes us to the second opinion leading up to SFFA, Grutter versus Bollinger. And the majority there specifically endorsed Justice Powell's view that student body diversity, academic freedom could be a compelling interest to justify these types of programs. However, it stressed the limits, no quotas, no specified percentage of particular racial groups. You couldn't insulate certain ethnic groups from the competition of the admissions process. The court there in Bollinger also made a point of saying that where there's risk of stereotyping or negative use of race, that could run into constitutional problems in these programs. And it stressed as well that at some point affirmative actions would have to end, and even said that a logical endpoint would potentially be 25 years after the decision, when at which point the majority assumed that the need for these types of admissions boosts or admissions programs would be unnecessary. So going on to what the majority said in SFFA, the majority first said, yes, we're going to strict scrutiny here, and that the admissions policies couldn't use, based on its reading of the prior two precedents, race as a stereotype or as a negative admissions factor. So Harvard here identified four potential interests, said training future leaders who would be leaders of a more diverse society. Secondly, preparing graduates to adapt to an increasingly pluralistic society. Third, better educating its students through diversity. Fourth, producing new knowledge stemming from diverse outlooks. And the majority said that these really, in its view, couldn't meet the bar of strict scrutiny because they were impossible to measure. It would be very difficult to figure out, for example, at what point students would be better educated through the diversity of a student body, or at which we would have gained sufficient new knowledge stemming from diverse outlooks. And that because these couldn't be measured, they weren't really judicially administrable, and thus really couldn't be classified as a compelling interest. The majority also faulted Harvard and UNC for not really articulating a meaningful connection between the affirmative action policies and the goals they would pursue. The majority noted that many of the racial categories used in these programs are arbitrary. For example, why is diversity better achieved by a student body that's hypothetically 15% Hispanic, and all those Hispanic students are have Mexican heritage, versus a student body that's only 10% Hispanic, but those Hispanic students are from a wider subset of heritage in Southern and Central American countries? Supreme Court said, you know, measuring that is basically just impossible for a court to do, in its view. The majority also noted that Harvard and UNC were using race as a negative. It honed in on the acknowledgement, you know, in the district court and even a little bit by Harvard and UNC, that race would be a determinative factor for at least some students. And the majority said, well, okay, if race is a tip in favor, then it also means there are certain students who didn't have that positive aspect on the bubble and thus would not be admitted because of their race. And that negative use of race, the majority said, was really impermissible under the precedents leading up to this decision. And finally, the majority noted that this would lead to stereotypes of certain racial groups, and that there wasn't any really logical endpoint to these programs. When have you achieved sufficient racial balancing, for example? Importantly, the majority gave us two caveats it established a general principle here that racial classifications or the use of sort of racial tips or pluses in the admission context is not permissible under the Equal Protection Clause, doesn't meet the bar of strict scrutiny, but said that the situation would be a little different for military academies. There could be national security justifications. And the majority also said that an applicant's race could be considered only insofar as a discussion by the applicant of how race or racism may have affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. Sort of a holistic view of how did this affect you as a person. Now, moving on very briefly to the dissents, Justice Sotomayor took issue with the majority, saying that race-neutral alternatives proposed by the majority, by SFFA, weren't really workable, that the Constitution in court's precedents in other areas of the law has permitted at least some racial classification. She pointed to Bignoni-Ponce, which is a Supreme Court decision basically saying that in the border control context near the border, DHS agents, for example, can take into account an individual's race, their Hispanic origins when deciding whether or not to apprehend them. Justice Sotomayor also rejected the view that race here would be using in a negative manner. She specifically had a quote saying that we're in a society where opportunities dispensed along racial lines, racial equality cannot be achieved without making room for underrepresented groups that for far too long were denied admission through the force of law. Moving on now to Justice Jackson's dissent, which it focuses more on the balancing of strict scrutiny and the interests at play. She rejects the majority's sort of underlying premise that our society can be colorblind. She says that our society has never been colorblind and that affirmative action is needed to address this reality, and that race still matters, and that without affirmative action, it will actually increase the racial disparities in admissions. Finally, Justice Thomas wrote sort of a response to these dissents and an elaboration on his views that actually affirmative action, in at least in the admissions context, is a violation of the equality principle. And he lays out many reasons why he thinks affirmative action actually disadvantages minorities, whether through mismatch of educational qualifications to the school the student is attending, stigma, hurting potentially other racial groups and thus promoting racial animosity. And he ends with a quote that I think is important, saying that the solution to our nation's racial problems, this cannot come from policies grounded in affirmative action or some other conception of equity. Racialism simply cannot be undone by different or more racialism. In the aftermath of this opinion, obviously everyone's trying to figure out, okay, what are the, you know, what is the breadth of the two exceptions that the majority gives us? And there's many different legal guidances that came out, but I want to focus here on the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and what they had to say about this opinion. They specifically emphasized a few different things that educational institutions should do to make sure that their admissions policies were complying with the majority opinion. They said that schools should obviously diligently comply with anti-discrimination laws, making sure that no one is denied admission because of race, which was emphasis in the majority opinion. They also encouraged admissions centers to reimagine and retool their policies by soliciting racial experiences and, for example, admissions essays, having students talk about how their unique heritage or cultural history might add to student body diversity, those types of things. And they also noted that you can solicit and consider, for example, whether an individual is the first in their family to attend college, whether they were from a socioeconomically disadvantaged background, and that through these sort of more race-neutral methods, they could achieve the same end goal of student body diversity. And with that, I know I'm a little bit over, and I will turn it over.
Very much, Leo. It's a fantastic introduction. Really appreciate it, especially your going into detail about some guidances that we've received after that decision came out. I know that one big one came from the Biden administration as well, so maybe we'll get into that a little bit later in the conversation. But let's hand the mic over to Anthony, who's next in line.
Thanks, Devin. Thanks, Leo, for opening. And thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this and everyone for attending. So Leo just talked about the law. I'm going to talk about what the law looks like when it's applied by universities and their admissions offices. So as Leo said, before Students for Fair Admissions, schools were allowed to consider race as a factor of a factor of a factor in admissions decisions. But the record in that case showed that admissions officers looked at an applicant's race at every step of the application decision process, likely from an applicant's self-identification included as part of the college application questions. So they admitted a class that was predetermined an arbitrary racial balance. So Students for Fair Admissions said that practice was never legal. So my presentation will give some examples on how class demographics have changed, what those changes may show, and admissions policy changes that were alluded to by Leo at the end of his presentation. So let's start with the demographic data. Unsurprisingly, we saw with a variety of patterns, and bear with me as I go through some statistics. So the first trend we've noticed is a sharp, statistically significant decrease in total Black, Hispanic, and Indigenous student enrollment, with perhaps an increase in Asian and or white student enrollment. So two schools that followed this trend were MIT, for example. The percentage of Asian American students skyrocketed from 40% to 47%. Meanwhile, Hispanic student enrollment dropped from 16 to 11%, and Black student enrollment dropped from 15 to 5%. White student enrollment stayed about constant, decreasing only 1%. Amherst saw a decrease of Black student representation from 11 to 3%. Combined Black, Hispanic, and Indigenous student enrollment dropped from 24 to 11%. Meanwhile, Asian student enrollment increased from 18 to 20%, and white student enrollment increased from 33 to 39%. This next category is similar numbers, but a slight decrease. So UNC Chapel Hill saw a slight decrease in Black and Hispanic student enrollment from 24 to 19%. And the last category, some schools saw a slight increase in total Black, Hispanic, and Indigenous student enrollment. For example, Yale and Duke each saw an increase of 1%. So what do these demographic changes mean? They mean a variety of things. So colleges with large demographic changes lied about what they were actually doing behind the scenes. They were systematically discriminating against Asian and white applicants in favor of Black, Hispanic, and Indigenous applicants. And another thing to note is that these trends appeared in MIT and Amherst, which means that the discrimination looks a little differently. MIT is an engineering school, and numbers are probably the most important part of an admissions decision, say GPA and test scores. So the boost could have come from different cutoffs for different demographic groups, whereas Harvard employed more of a soft third character trait factor to discriminate. Amherst, on the other hand, is test optional and strongly assesses the quality of writing as demonstrated by essays, the writing supplement, and testing and recommendations. So we see the soft bigotry of low expectations applied to the non-numerical portions of a college application. So it's worth looking at the next time we may have a Students for Fair Admissions-like case to examine the essays. So next, when the numbers didn't change at all, remember, admissions is a black box. We don't know for sure whether schools with minor demographic changes had admissions practices that violated Title VI or the Equal Protection Clause. We only have a trial record on Harvard and UNC. And the same could be said for schools with increased representation. Could be that students who were not as strong candidates at the most selective schools found themselves in a very competitive position at a school like Duke, where they were admitted and attended. And of course, it can also mean that universities are still doing what the Supreme Court prohibited. So when should we be concerned with what we see at universities. So I won't be able to cover every way that schools can run around students for fair admissions in the short amount of time we have. But my main red flags to look out for are major changes in the application process, especially after Students for Fair Admissions was decided, consistently similar racial demographics year after year, like we saw at Harvard, but we won't be able to tell that for a couple years. Statements by universities and explicit consideration of race somewhere at the school. So now I'll talk about some of those examples. So let's assume, like I said earlier, that schools don't have access to an applicant's self-disclosure of his race in the college application. One way that they could get access to it is to force it out of applicants. The easiest way to do that is to require someone to show up for an interview. For example, after Students for Fair Admissions was decided, Columbia Law School changed its application material requirements to include a 90-second video essay asking applicants to answer a question at random. They may not learn much about an applicant, but they certainly could see what an applicant looks like in 90 seconds. After some backlash, this process was removed. Essay questions are another way to get applicants to disclose their race, likely even before they are asked to show up for an interview. So some institutions have generated prompts that essentially require applicants to disclose their race. For example, Sarah Lawrence College quotes from Roberts's decision, the essay exception, and asks applicants to reflect on how the Supreme Court decision will impact their college experience. So let's assume that schools don't collect the demographic data, like I just mentioned, in this case, the Biden administration released joint guidance between the Department of Education and Department of Justice that schools could use proxies. There are two ways the administration suggested this. First is a direct substitution. So a common one is substituting geography with race. One example we've seen is the University of Virginia is targeting applications from 40 high schools with few historical applicants. There's nothing to suggest that these applicants from 40 schools are more qualified or as qualified as applicants from other parts of the country, or they're trying to boost their admissions revenue by soliciting more applications from places they haven't received it. This raises a red flag that UVA is trying to circumvent the law. The Biden administration also suggested another more complicated regime I like to call a second order discrimination. So to illustrate this, I'll give you an example. Harvard Law established a pre-law program for, quote, underrepresented students called Future Leaders in Law. Here, underrepresentation is the proxy for race here to fill in the pre-law program with the targeted demographics. Then, if Harvard Law were to follow the Biden administration's guidance, Harvard will give preference to graduates of its pre-law program. The idea here is to avoid strict scrutiny at the time the law school makes an admissions decision, because assuming there was no consideration of race, choosing between applicants who one graduated from a pre-law program and two didn't would be subject to rational basis. Also worth noting, Harvard partners with a law firm to administer the program. Harvard could in the future allow the law firm to run its own program, but admit students from that program. In that case, Harvard would outsource the discriminatory decisions to fill the pre-law program in the future and try to reduce its liability. So schools may say that admissions might be too risky because it's been under scrutiny, and we've seen cases about that. Schools have turned to financial aid awards, which are closely related to admissions because they occur around the same time, to get a class with the targeted racial demographics. So we see three examples of this. The first is discriminatory scholarships that are restricted to particular applicants. So for example, the W.E.B. Du Bois Fellowship at West Virginia University Law School provides an annual stipend plus tuition and other benefits for students who identify as African-American or Black. The American Alliance for Equal Rights brought similar lawsuits against law firms that had similar practices, and they quickly settled because they did not survive strict scrutiny. The next is manipulating the need threshold. So Oklahoma University recently is facing a class action that need-based awards are determined according to race. So there are some federal requirements to determine a student's need. However, as one school describes it, schools have their own institutional methodologies that are proprietary and complex. So that means it's secret and up to the school on how they determine your financial need is. So since it's so closely held and we don't have as much information on that, like schools don't publish their financial aid awards or individuals don't publish it usually on online forums, we know less about this process. And in fact, this lawsuit was brought because of a comment made by a university official to one of the named class members. The last thing we've seen is financial aid pooling. So assuming that there's no consideration of race in determining an applicant's financial need, schools still allocate need-based funds based on race. To give you an example, a hypothetical example, say there's a prominent Latina alumna who credits her alma mater for helping her to get the skills to become a Fortune 500 CEO. So she creates the Latinas in Business Scholarship. So then when a Latina high schooler who has a demonstrated financial need of $5,000 wrote a college application essay about starting her own company, she would be awarded the Latina in Business Scholarship funds. Colleges say this is legal because the recipient receives money only based on the financial need. And it's also a way to foster inclusion because the scholarship is perfectly matched with her. However, this scheme is likely illegal because it still requires a federal institution receiving funds to make decisions based on race. And the need-based amount depends on the class's demographics. So I'll conclude with this point. Be vigilant. Getting the students for fair admissions took decades, but that was the easy part. Right after Students for Fair Admissions came out, the University of Michigan's general counsel advised staff members at law schools to be conscious of the record you're creating and come up with a race-neutral explanation for all your policies. So the use of race in college admissions will become more creative, more complicated, harder to detect, and harder to prove. And I hope I shined some spotlight on ways that could be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really, really enlightening. We've got about 100 people on this call, and I suspect a good many of them sort of furrowed their brow when you said Students for Fair Admissions case was the easy part. That was a long time in the making, and to get the decision that that we got, a lot of folks would say wasn't easy. But I understand what you're saying. This fight is not over if we really care about equality of opportunity and non-discrimination, equal protection, based on a lot of what you just explained in terms of demographic changes and so forth, or lack thereof, as the case may be. Really appreciate those comments. Looking forward to our Q&A and our discussion at the tail end here. Peter, I'm going to hand the mic over. Or I'm sorry, Sam, you're up next. I'm going to hand the mic to you.
Awesome. Thanks, Devin. And thanks, Leo and Anthony, for setting such a high bar for the presentations here today. I should start by underlining once again that the views expressed in the following discussion are only my own and not that of the United States government, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC staff. That said, there are two important things I want to talk about that are sort of follow-ons or next steps after Students for Fair Admissions. The first that Leo mentioned is footnote 4 from the Students for Fair Admission majority decision. For those that don't keep an internal registry of Supreme Court footnotes, footnote 4 read, the U.S. as amicus contends that race-based admissions programs further compelling interests at our nation's military academies. No military academy is a party to these cases, however, and none of the courts below address the propriety of race-based admissions in that context. This opinion also does not address the issue in light of potentially distinct interests military academies may present. Sort of immediately after the Students for Fair Admissions decision was released in September of 2023, Students for Fair Admissions launched a new lawsuit, this time naming as defendant the United States Military Academy at West Point. As the defendant seeking declaratory judgment against their affirmative action programs in the same way as against Harvard and UNC. And more recently, in December of 2024, last year, a similar lawsuit was launched against the United States Air Force Academy. We really have a lot of detail about the United States Military Academy case, West Point, where the case has been dismissed from the Supreme Court on preliminary injunction standing. The government, the DOJ in that case, raised the need for a diverse officer corps as a national security interest and invoked deference to the United States military in making the determination of what sort of interests are important for national security determinations and their ability to construct an officer corps that they feel is most efficient for the national defense. I should start by making clear, I never personally served in the armed forces, and I certainly don't claim to be an expert on warfighter effectiveness or military lethality. So I can't really pick particularly that judgment by the United States military. But what I can touch on is a general version, both myself and I think increasingly in the case law, towards sort of hand-waving exercises by agencies or instrumentalities of the government, where they make a general statement and they're entitled to deference in that statement. And so I think while certainly plausibly there are national security interests for the United States military in having a diverse officer corps, or at least an officer corps whose racial composition is similar or like to the enlisted personnel inside the military, there's room for disagreement there. I mean, the most recent study that the military has conducted on this front that was cited in the United States Military Academy case was done during the Vietnam War, and race relations have changed significantly since that study was conducted. And also, there are certainly differences between a military composed of draftees versus now we obviously have an all-volunteer force. This becomes somewhat of a political football as well. I mean, secretaries of defense can plausibly disagree on whether or not a diverse officer corps, or what the construction of a diverse officer corps in terms of different racial compositions might be in order to serve the national defense. That's not to say there are no reasons that are clear why a diverse officer corps or certain members of certain racial or ethnic groups might be necessary to have within our nation's officer corps. One good example cited may be engagements in certain theaters, for example, the Middle East, might require more officers of an ethnic, racial, or language background that is present and necessary within those theaters, creating a sincere national security interest to increase the composition of the officer corps, which has either those cultural competencies or those language competencies. That said, the military academies are not the only officer ascension path available to the United States military. The United States Military Academy accounts only for about 25% of new second lieutenants in each given year. There are significant alternative pathways, which may be available on race-neutral grounds, that the United States military can achieve a diverse officer corps without using affirmative action in its university admissions decisions. I think there's definitely room in these cases for deference to the military, the Department of Defense, in making determinations about, you know, to what extent a diverse officer corps may be necessary for the national defense. But there's also room for SCOTUS to require the military to do a better job of defining why exactly it is, rather that they need particular racial compositions in their officer corps, rather than just alluding to a generic diversity. The other issue that I want to talk about, which I also think is sort of a follow-on from the Students for Fair Admission, the Harvard and UNC cases, is cases like Coalition for TJ and Boston's Parent Coalition. These cases address K-12 magnet or other special admissions program schools in primary education. Students for Fair Admission and affirmative action more generally really addresses what might be called overt racial discrimination, decisions made facially on the basis of race rather than on some race-neutral criteria. But what Coalition for TJ and Boston's Parents Coalition really raise are the possibility of facially race-neutral policies, which are designed or result in disparate impacts on particular racial groups. This isn't really an advancing of the ball necessarily from Students for Fair Admissions. It's the other side of the coin, right? Facially discriminatory policies versus facially neutral policies, both designed to land at some desired racial outcome. In both Coalition for TJ and Boston Parent Coalition, both had cert rejected, but both received vigorous dissents from the denial of cert from Justice Alito. These cases are important for any number of reasons. First, normatively, well-qualified members of and young members of these, especially Asian American racial groups, are being denied educational opportunities that they otherwise may be qualified for on the basis of their race, candidly. And there's certainly some evidence and certainly Coalition for TJ of particular racial design in coming up with facially neutral criteria for making these admissions decisions. In disparate impact analyses more generally, which really can be applied in these contexts, it's not readily clear what the substantial legitimate justification for making these race neutral changes that result in a significant disparate racial impact. If you followed that, that's great. It's not clear what those are, other than the same diversity interest that's being alluded to by Harvard and UNC in the Students for Fair Admissions case, which was just recently held to be not sufficient. I'm going to go ahead and skip ahead. I think Justice Alito put it best in his dissent from denial of cert in Coalition for TJ. And what he said is, in essence, what the lower circuit is holding is that racial discrimination can stand so long as it's not too severe. This reasoning is indefensible and cries out for correction. It's hugely problematic for disparate impact analysis generally, and without further work, it will allow schools to continue to implement race-neutral, facially race-neutral policies to arrive at some desired racial composition. And I think it's important that those be held to be constitutionally impermissible, the same way that facially race discriminatory policies are.
So much, Sam. I really appreciate that, especially tying this to the work that the Pacific Legal Foundation is doing on proxy discrimination in the K-12 context. As you suggested, you know, what we're dealing with there is sort of an order of magnitude more difficult. And this is something that Anthony was discussing, right? This is not overt race discrimination. We want to describe it as that. This is sort of a workaround to get at the same result, is at least what the Pacific Legal Foundation has been putting forward. This is against 13-year-olds. These aren't even, if you consider 18-year-olds adults, these aren't even adults that we're talking about here who are applying to college or university. Pacific Legal Foundation is doing great work there. The Center for Equal Opportunity has supported at least one of their cases, the Thomas Jefferson High School case at the CERT stage. And we want to continue to support what they're doing. I think that's one of the next frontiers in this type of work. We don't have a ton of time left, but I definitely want to hear from Peter. Peter, take as much time as you need, and then we'll have an opportunity to talk with each other around the horn.
Thank you, Devin, and thank you, Leo, Anthony, and Sam. When I did the inaugural Civil Rights Fellowship with Center for Equal Opportunity back a few years ago, the prevailing impression and thought I had as I was talking to the other fellows and all of the attorneys that we worked with is, wow, I'm allowed to be in the same room as these people. I get to talk and have these discussions with them. These are just some truly brilliant, brilliant minds that I count myself fortunate to be able to work with. And that actually informs what I want to talk about a little bit here. It's extremely easy for attorneys, particularly very capable and brilliant attorneys that work on, you know, the appellate level and in federal courts and things like that, to think a certain way and to view a certain set of events as sort of your win conditions. You know, if to kind of tweak the metaphor, if you're a hammer, everything's a nail. If you're an appellate civil rights lawyer that kind of works in these circles, then you're a very, very specific hex key that's convinced that everything's a screw with a very specific thread pitch. You know, it's even more specific still. So it's easy for us to think only in terms of what is the case that we want? What is the client that we're looking for? How do we advance things? Well, I principally what I want to go back to is what Anthony said about SFFA v. Harvard being the easy part. And that's actually what I want to focus on, because I think he's exactly right. And my point is, since public interest lawyers and, you know, very intelligent people think, okay, we've got what we've been working for decades. Great. We've won. This is what we're looking for. When in reality, I think what everybody has said is this added another tool to a toolbox for a lot of work that still remains to be done. You know, we're still going to see lots of efforts of end runs and things trying to diminish the importance of merit in education, in employment, and elsewhere. So I think it's critical for us to be able to not rest on the gains that have been made in this area of civil rights, but to push it forward and to continue and ensure that, you know, the most qualified students are getting what they need and that the education that they get is superior. Now, this is another area where I think it's easy to kind of lose sight of what we're really talking about. I think any one of us might agree that, you know, even admissions, getting into college was the easy part. You know, then you had to get through college, you had to do that, then you had to go out and get a job. I think the same holds true here. There's a major step that's been achieved with this major case, but that is only the start of what we need to do. And there's a lot that remains left to be done. Finally, before I turn things back over to talking about, you know, having a conversation amongst ourselves, like Devin stated that we're looking for, is I kind of want to, I don't want to rain on the parade isn't the right word, but I do want to perhaps kind of interject a little bit of realism, because on its own, this one opinion isn't going to change anything. Ultimately, it's going to be, it must become a prevailing opinion that individual merit and experience and all of that needs to dominate over racial preference. And that's not something that we can immediately achieve in the courtroom. And that comes back to where I'm saying we always want to fix everything with litigation, but that's only part of it. We need to be insisting on this in our own communities. All of this conversation about Coalition for TJ hits a little bit home, because I am a Fairfax County resident with school-aged children. So, you know, that's an instance where I where that hits kind of close to home. And if we're relying on very smart litigators to carry the ball for us, then we're not doing our part to ensure at every level that students are getting the best education that they possibly can. And one Supreme Court opinion on its own is not going to realize that goal. It rests with all of us to continue to litigate with all of these new opportunities that we have now, with rules being a little bit clearer and perhaps a little bit more favorable, and also to insist on that in our own communities. And with that, Devin, I'll hand that back to you.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thanks to all of you for your insight, for your thoughts. Again, this is a great opportunity to have new blood, new lawyers with new eyes, a different generation thinking about and talking about these types of issues. Again, this is one of the reasons why the Federal Society is holding these types of programs. That's why the Center for Equal Opportunity has been deliberate about training and providing instruction to law students who are becoming really fine, really brilliant, capable attorneys like all of you, Peter. So we're very happy that we're able to do this. We've got about 10 minutes left. I've got sort of a question for everyone. I've got a couple questions for everyone, and I want to start with my first one, following up on something that Peter said. Peter sort of threw cold water on us, as he said, or something of that nature. I wonder whether it's all cold water. I mean, obviously, Peter, you say, look, you know, we got this big decision from last term. That's huge. But it's really only the starting point. Anthony suggests something similar. You know, the hard part starts now. What is your response to people who say, look, we've got a new federal government administration coming in. It matters a whole lot. The type of people who run federal government agencies and who are tasked with holding universities and colleges feet to the fire when it comes to the law. We're likely to get really good people in that role. I don't think it's been announced yet who's going to run the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education, for example, but we do know who's running this, the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, Harmeet Dhillon. They've made these people overtures about how they want to beat back, right? A lot of what we've seen in terms of the overreach of diversity, equity, inclusion measures, critical race theory, affirmative action. And then also, it seems to me that there's a shift in sort of the zeitgeist around these things as well, right? We see a lot of people from very recently, at least, you know, elections have consequences, from Silicon Valley and other places sort of getting on board with rolling back these types of measures that take race into account and so forth. Should our spirits be buoyed a little bit that the decision from last year in Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard versus the University of North Carolina actually did a lot to move the ball forward on these issues and that we really have a lot to look forward to? Or should it all be a sort of cold water? Where do y'all stand on this?
I'll jump in. I think Students for Fair Admissions is absolutely, I agree, a starting point. It's certainly not where, and I don't think it is, where litigators are stopping and saying job done, job's not done. But I think it is, as you mentioned, it's important as a cultural marker, as a shifting point, and an allowance of our culture to accept the idea that these policies really are not as benign as one might have believed, and they do have consequences, and there will be a shift as they're rolled back. I think it's also important, as you mentioned, that we could be moving to an administration that's more vigorous about pursuing perceived violations of this decision and the need for race neutrality in admissions decisions. And so I think that's maybe its biggest use is as a starting point. And as a baseline, but I absolutely agree. And as I talked about, there's a lot more work, both to set that baseline on the race neutral front, but also just following directly from Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and UNC, and building on those opinions.
What thoughts?
I think we won't see any change until we really hit them where it hurts, which is their pockets. Look, we have a trial record that shows that people were discriminating, right? Like, people paid application fees to get their applications reviewed. Parents worked so hard to spend thousands of dollars to send test scores and applications. And shouldn't it be an implied contract that they review the applications fairly? Sue schools for their application fees. Right? Just because, say, there's a change in the future administration doesn't mean that this thing can happen again. We have to teach them a lesson, which comes with hitting them where it hurts, which is their pockets.
And I appreciate that both of you have mentioned sort of the cultural aspect on this. And this doesn't begin and end with higher education. Because at some point we have to ask ourselves, at what point did discriminatory enrollment become a hill for people to die on? You know, why? You know, why did that become a way? I think it's because certain narratives have become entrenched culturally, and then that starts in primary schools and, you know, secondary and, you know, as early as elementary school and whatever else, which means, well, you're absolutely correct. This needs to start in very, very specific and creative ways. I love your suggestion about suing for application fees. I never thought of that, and I think that's brilliant. Perhaps another example is greater participation in local school boards and things like that. So that way you can try and influence what the culture should be. I think this previous election kind of laid bare that more people want change from current education policy than a lot of outlets would have you believe. And I think that we need to kind of knuckle down and kind of demonstrate that and try and change things culturally and to see progress over an extended period of time.
And just to hop on, Devin, if you don't mind, before I say anything, I'll just preface with any personal views I may express are purely my own. But I know maybe answering a different aspect of the question just Devin just asked, lurking in the background, maybe a sense that the SFFA decision doesn't really do much. We've got the exceptions. Maybe is that opening wide a barn door to backdoor considerations of race that Anthony has already laid out? And maybe to assuage a little bit of that, I would like to point out that the decision itself is a big jurisprudential shift from what came before. The decision itself basically says that educational diversity rationales, increasing the diversity of the student body, diverse backgrounds, learning environment, academic freedom, are not sufficient to justify racial discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause. And that certainly is a big change from Bakke, et cetera. And I would also note that even the exception itself of allowing a student to talk about how race has affected their personality, their character in an essay is not that broad. The majority specifically Camden's language saying that, but despite the dissent's assertion to the contrary, universities may not simply establish through application essays or other means the regime we hold unlawful today. The Constitution deals with substance, not shadows, and the prohibition against racial discrimination is leveled at the thing, not the name. A benefit to a student who overcame racial discrimination, for example, must be tied to that student's courage and determination, or a benefit to a student whose heritage or culture motivated him or her to assume a leadership role or attain a particular goal must be tied to that student's unique ability to contribute to the university. So again, the Supreme Court is even tying that exception back to an individual consideration of what merit does that student have? What's their character? How are they going to contribute to the university? Which is an important shift from before.
Appreciate that, Leo. I mean, this was a large jurisprudential shift to some extent, and we ought to recognize it as such, even if we believe there's still a lot more that needs to be done legally from a policy standpoint and culturally. We only have about 2 minutes left. I do have sort of a closing question, and I wonder whether any of you have any thoughts on it, and maybe none of you do, but I'm curious. So one of the things that happened, that did happen actually in this decision, which a lot of people were really kind of surprised about, is that the Grutter decision from 2003 that solidified this idea that the educational benefits from a diverse student body justifies affirmative action or can overcome strict scrutiny so long as it's narrowly tailored in achieving it. Was not overturned. Grutter was not overturned. I read a Harvard Crimson article recently from a Harvard Law School graduate who indicated that but for the diversity that was the result of affirmative action at Harvard Law School, she would not be as good a lawyer as she is today. It was an interesting article, and I committed to you. It's only from a few weeks ago, Harvard Crimson. It's the Harvard University's newspaper. Do any of you think, despite what your legal thoughts are and policy thoughts and so forth, you've already shared those about affirmative race, affirmative action. Do any of you think that by losing diversity on campuses, as Anthony laid out in terms of the demographics that we're seeing post SFFA, that we're losing anything in terms of educational benefits or otherwise?
I think you have to look at the facts on the ground, and I say that as a trial lawyer, right? Change in diversity in one school might mean totally something different at another school. So, for example, Clarence Thomas's concurrence referenced that even in classes with, say, a high racial diversity, there are segregated housing, segregated student groups, that prevent students from interacting with each other and getting the benefits of diversity. So it really requires a further inquiry into the conditions of each school.
I would say diversity and interacting with those with different viewpoints can be important without serving as a justification for racial discrimination. You know, diversity is not unimportant just because you can't use it to discriminate on the basis of race.
I also think it can be reductive to say that by removing discrimination, you're going to reduce diversity. I think that over time, diversity will begin to reassert itself as everybody from every background is ultimately elevated by having higher expectations. I think that is a possibility that is not considered often enough in the conversation.
Just want to say we're 1 minute over time now. We have to wrap things up. I really appreciate all of you agree. I mean, you're new lawyers. You're billing by 6 minute increments. Some of you, and I really appreciate you sharing your time with us today and your perspectives. I want to thank the audience for joining us and thank the Federal Society again for holding this. I hope that we'll have many more of these new voices in civil rights programs as we have new up and comers, and particularly in the civil rights space. If you're interested in this type of thing, you want to be one of these bright, articulate, capable attorneys that you saw on the program here, and you're a law student out there, please think about applying to the Center for Equal Opportunities Civil Rights Fellowship. It's 1 week over the summer. It's an opportunity to learn from experts in this field, network with them, and then come back at some point and be the expert yourself on a New Voices program for the Federal Society or in some other context. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.